From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. While the cost of attending college in the U.S. is a burgeoning problem, one that burdens millions of students with unpayable debts, a lesser-discussed college-related scandal is graduation rates. College dropout rates in the U.S. are appallingly high. Overall, about 40% of people enrolled in four-year colleges or universities will graduate within a six-year period. For students of color, especially African American and Latinx, the number is even higher. Writing about this scandal over graduation levels is my guest, David Kerp. He's written a book examining the factors that keep students from graduating and exploring the models that have worked. David Kerp is a professor at UC Berkeley and a contributing writer at the New York Times and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, as well as of the National Academy of Education. His earlier book was called Improbable Scholars: The Rebirth of a Great American School System and a Strategy for America's Schools. He now joins me to discuss his newest book called simply The College Dropout Scandal. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you so much for having me.
So scandal is a strong word. When I saw the actual numbers you were referring to, I had to agree it is a scandal, but it's not one that we talk about very much. If I were to just look at these numbers, I might imagine, well, of course, the cost of going to college or university today is just so high. Maybe people just can't afford it anymore, or they just don't want to be burdened with the loans when they once they realize how much it costs. But in your book, you write that there are many, many complex reasons why people drop out. So get into that. Why is it that these rates are so high?
Well, I think it's a scandal, and it's a strong word, and I used it deliberately because not only are those rates high, you've got 40% of students not graduating in 6 years. We now have strategies that we know can move the needle on student success, and they're not being widely used, apparently, because that dropout rate hasn't budged. And as you were saying, I mean, the cost of dropping out is huge. I mean, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars to taxpayers. We're talking about the $1 million premium, the lifetime premium that a bachelor's degree is worth, something that the students are gonna forgo. In fact, if they drop out, they're not making a whole lot more money than if they had just graduated from high school and hadn't carried on. But they can't get the kind of jobs that they need to pay off the debt they're gonna have. And so they're more likely to default on college loans, have a harder time getting college mortgages, and a whole bunch of other things are different. They're less likely to participate in politics, to be engaged in their community. Their lives are really changed by this experience. And the scandal is that colleges could be doing so much more about this, and they're not.
So what is, let's examine the data, because there have been a lot of studies, and your book points out from individual colleges trying to study why their rates dropout rates are so high, to broader studies. What beyond the cost are the factors that cause people to feel like it's just not worth it and drop out of college?
Well, I think that college is often, you would think that making student success a priority would be so obvious. It's like who's buried in Grant's tomb, but it's not. I mean, most college presidents will talk about student success, but they won't do anything much to make it a reality. They're going to be focused on raising money, on moving up the U.S. News and World Report, prestige scale. They're not going to look at the students they have. And so the consequence of that is you take two colleges whose admissions profiles, freshmen, are exactly the same, and their graduation rates could vary by 20%. And then you take two colleges with the same graduation rates, and the gap between new gen students, poor students, minority students, first generation to go to college, and the overall student body can also vary by 20%. You have some colleges that have basically eliminated that gap, and others where you've got a 20, 30, even 40% gap in graduation rates. So what colleges need to do is to go, if they're going to take this seriously, is to figure out what are the roadblocks to student success, and how can they remove them? That's the first thing they need to do. And then overall, what they need to figure out is how can they make students feel like they belong to the institution, that they're members of a community that values them for more than their tuition check. A lot of strategies to get there, But that's the ultimate goal, to give students a sense of belonging, not just a sense of alienation.
You point out in your book that even just finding the right college to, you know, be a good match for students can determine whether that student will graduate or drop out, and that it actually doesn't take much to help students be matched to schools that would better suit them.
It's true. There's a conversation about quote unquote overmatching, that minority students are going to schools that are, you know, too hard for them, and they'd be better off at less selective schools. And in fact, the reverse is true. The problem is that poor students and minority students see the sticker price of colleges, and they just get scared off, and they don't realize that often these colleges have scholarship programs and loan programs that actually make it cheaper for them to go there than to go to the state schools nearby that have a higher dropout rate. I think that, I mean, big public universities are the engine of education mobility in this country. But students should really look broadly at what their options are. And they should particularly think twice before going to community colleges as a stepping stone to a four-year school. Again, I learned a lot about great community colleges, but if you look at the data, student is much less likely to graduate if she starts a community college and then wants to transfer than if she started as a full-time student at a four-year school. And that full-time really? Is really important. Hmm. If she only goes part-time, she basically has reduced by about 40% the chances that she's going to graduate.
And of course, so many of these things are linked to money and to the access to money. A lot of students go part-time because they might need jobs to sustain themselves, but maybe they're not aware of the scholarships.
And a college can deal with that question. I mean, so that's a roadblock, right? Students need money. That's obviously a big roadblock. Well, what some colleges do is they create block schedules that are predictable, so students know they're going to be in class Monday, Wednesday, Friday afternoon. Okay, that leaves them the rest of the time, or chunk of the rest of the time, either to work or to handle family responsibilities, as opposed to having to take courses that are scattered over the week. So you start with a problem, and then again, if you're in the business of worrying about students or paying attention to students, if you really think of yourself as accountable to students, then you can look for solutions, or at least remedies.
What about male students versus female students? Do you find differences in dropout rates between genders?
There is. There is about a 10% difference in dropout rates. Men are less likely to go to college these days than women, and they're more likely to drop out.
Less, and so men are less likely to drop out and to go to college. And more likely to drop out. I did not expect
yes,
that.
Yes, exactly. Huh. I actually just recently, I hadn't thought about that question. I looked at that. I mean, those numbers surprised me as much as they surprised you.
So what are some of the strategies that individual colleges have taken up that could be applied across the board?
Well, one thing that colleges do from the outset, and here's a problem I didn't know existed. It's called summer melt. A high school student gets accepted by a college, pays her deposit, and then never shows up. And at big state schools, that can be 20-25% of the students who are admitted.
Wow.
I know, summer melts. So what do you do about summer melt? Well, students live on texts. So you send them texts which basically say, you know, and the reason for this, by the way, isn't that they're being lazy. It's that there's a lot of paperwork to do. And if you don't have the kind of support from family or from counselors that helps you do it, you can just find yourself swimming and unable to actually make something, get it together. So nudges that say you've got to, you know, complete your financial aid form, and if you're having problems, you can contact us and we'll walk through it with you. Those nudges can make a huge difference. At Georgia State, which is one of the great universities in terms of thinking about student success, they reduce their summer melt rate from 18% to 12%. So that's a 33% reduction, just entirely based on almost cost-free nudges to students. So that's one thing you can do. At the other end of the college experience, universities discover that students are dropping out with just a semester to go. And when they look, they figure out a reason is they've run out of loan funds and they're $1,000, $500 short, which they can't pay. And so these schools are now saying, we're going to give them $1,000. They have this problem, we'll just give it to them. It's not a loan, it's a scholarship. And, you know, when students get over being shocked by this, it makes a huge difference, not only in their ability to pay, but also in their feelings about the university, because it's a really tangible way for the university to say, you know, we've got your back. But those are just two examples that are not wildly expensive and that make a big difference.
I want to go back to what you were saying earlier around the experiences of students of color in college. Do you find that the colleges and universities could do a lot more to make minority students feel more welcome? I mean, there's been a lot of discussion around this. There's been a TV show about it, Netflix's Dear White People, about, you know, Black college students trying to assert themselves and fight for their right to exist equally alongside white students at an elite college. Could universities be doing a lot more to make minority students feel like their university belongs to them in a space that, you know, traditionally, historically, has been shut out to them? Academics has been it's been racially defined historically.
No, I think you hit upon the key. The key is for universities to figure out ways to make minority students, who are not the students who are usually attending or haven't in the past attended the elite colleges, make them feel that they belong, that their contribution is enormously valued, that this is no longer just a college for white upper middle class students. And that's, you know, it sometimes takes a real push, a real set of demands to get the college to work on that set of issues. At Amherst College, which I write about in the book, Amherst admits more new gen students, that is Pell Grant students, first in their family to go to college students, and underrepresented minorities, than any other elite school. But it's one thing to admit, it's another thing to say, okay, you're bringing something to the table. It's not just that we're going to give you an education. And that starts by listening to students and figuring out what do they want. You know, and that may be, you know, as simple and as important as having available to them counselors who understand the situation they're going through and are going to listen to them and are going to help them, as opposed to not having that kind of support, leaving these students on their own. And also, you know, there's a book that came out recently by Tony Jack, whose title I'm forgetting for the moment. The Privileged Poor is what I think it's called. And he looks at the kinds of mistakes that an elite university makes that can only alienate students. And I'll just tell you one of them. The summer before freshman year, students are invited to go to all sorts of experiences. They can go to Europe and go to galleries. They can go on an outward bound trip to someplace in the mountains. They pay for those trips. If they need to make money, guess what? They can earn $13 an hour by cleaning the rooms of the students who've left the previous spring. And guess who takes those jobs as effectively maids and janitors? It's the minority students. And they wind up continuing in those jobs during the course of the academic year because the university, in its infinite wisdom, pays those students a dollar an hour more than they would be getting paid if they worked, say, in the library. So again, imagine you're a minority student and you're cleaning the rooms of other students. What kind of a signal does that send? So that's just the kind of grossness that goes on. But there's just lots of points of sensitivity and attentiveness that universities need to pay to hear minority students' voices.
And we know that it's such a competitive and cutthroat situation when it comes to college admissions, as we saw the recent scandal around what the elite parents of kids do to buy their kids way into colleges, you know, even breaking the law. And a lot of poor students of color have to compete with that. Did the Supreme Court decision, Fisher versus University of Texas, around affirmative action impact, because now we've had some time to assess its impact, impact negatively the participation of students of color in colleges?
Well, again, if we focus on elite colleges, the elite private colleges, they haven't been affected by Fisher, and indeed the percentage of minority students. And again, it's really important to be clear that we're talking not about minority students who are, you know, who are the the children of lawyers and doctors, but we're talking about kids who've gone to inner city schools and really had to work hard to make it. The numbers of those kids are actually going up. But again, I think the issue really has to do with how they're received on campus. And it's not just what the institution does. One of my favorite students from last year, you know, talked about the amount of racism among students, the assumption that he had to be an affirmative action admit because he was Latino. I mean, he's the smartest student in my class. Didn't matter. That was, you know, that kind of attitude, which is all too prevalent. You know, you only got here because you're Black. You only got here because you're Latino. You know, just imagine, I just imagine what the impact of that is on students. You can't imagine students not internalizing that and thinking, and that's indeed what the social psychologists show, those students are going to start feeling like that they're inferior. And that's a disaster. That's a human tragedy, and that's something that institutions need to address.
Some might say, well, we live at a time when the cost of going to college may not be worth the benefits of it. Is there too great a desire among, you know, all families that kids go to college? You know, we've had this idea that the U.S. is a meritocracy. You know, are we putting too much stock in a college education?
Well, if you look at the economics, one thing that's worth noting is that the average college student who's taken out loans graduates with about $25,000 in debt. Now, that's a lot of money to a poor kid, but it's not in the larger sphere of things, that's not a huge amount of money. The big debt figures come from graduate education, professional education, and particularly the for-profit schools, which are just a nightmare. The premium, as long as there's a huge income premium to getting a bachelor's degree, it's hard to say to students, nah, you shouldn't be going to college. It's $1 million over the lifetime of a student that degree is worth. Now, having said that,
So just to clarify, that means that if you go to college, you're on average likely to earn $1 million more dollars over your entire lifetime than if you don't go to college.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, there are lots of blue collar jobs that pay very well where there are job vacancies. You know, plumbers, carpenters, electricians. And these days, those are jobs that demand a considerable amount of education. You don't just go into a training program to do that. But we tend to, to dismiss those jobs, to say, you know, there's all that language about college or career, but, you know, people seem to forget the career part of this. And so I think broadening the notion of the kinds of careers that people can have, the kinds of lives that people can live, the kinds of preparation that they need would help a lot. And again, those are jobs. They're going to be well-paying jobs. Those are the kind of jobs that are going to lift somebody into the middle class.
A lot of presidential candidates are talking about the idea of making college free for all. Several states are considering this as well. And of course, while this wouldn't necessarily address, at least in the short term, how colleges can take steps to make students feel more welcome, would a policy of free college, or at least working toward that idea, help increase graduation rates?
So if I was going to invest in higher education, I would invest in doing all the things that a university can do, and we can talk about them, to boost graduation rates. Because it's one thing to get more students into college, but it's really important to help the students who are there to graduate. And remember that 40% figure. You can cut that in half, and there are many schools that have done that, that are graduating 20 and 30% more students than institutions with the same kind of admissions standards. It's doable. And that, it seems to me, that's the neglected point in this conversation. A lot of the free tuition proposals focus on community college, and there are sort of depressing data that says that students who would otherwise be going to four-year schools choose community colleges because they're free, and the consequence of that is they're less likely to earn a degree, because that's just the reality of going to community college. It's a complicated story, in addition to the fact that, you know, the big beneficiaries, it turns out, about free college are going to be middle and upper middle class families who are going to take full advantage of that option. But I don't want to I don't want to argue. This is not a, this is a bad idea conversation. It sure. is the thing that nobody is talking about. And the reason that I wrote this book is to shed light on the fact that we've got these, you know, they're, all these students are in college. You know, you've got a million students a year showing up, you know, in four-year colleges. 40% of those students aren't going to make it. That's 400,000 students a year that we're talking about whose futures have been affected by the institution's failures to take seriously what it is they can do to remove the roadblocks. And again, yes, money is an issue, but boy, does money not account for everything.
So putting in a small amount of money into certain means or certain efforts would go a longer way, you suggest, such as, you know, all of those various ways in which colleges can reach out to students and address those minor things that seem minor, but that may add up over time that end up discouraging the students from continuing. And it seems to be a no-brainer. Are colleges invested in keeping students in school? Do the colleges lose out when students drop out? I mean, are colleges measured by their own dropout rates?
That's a great question. Because, you know, if you had a high school that had a 60% graduation rate, it would be called a dropout factory and the principal would be looking for another job. But there is no accountability like that in higher education. Mm-hmm. Nobody loses their job because of dropout rates. And there really are pretty straightforward things that you can do. One thing that we know from a ton of data is that counseling is crucial. That students are often feeling at sea, nobody understands them, they're afraid to talk to their professors, they think that they're dumb, they failed an exam and don't know what to do. We've got a whole bunch of personal problems that are interfering with their ability to be a student. And when I talk to students, I mean, to a person, they are lauding their advisors and their counselors by saying, you know, I was just talking to a few students the other day, and they said, you know, my counselor is like my big sister. And two of them said, my, you know, it's like having a second mom. That relationship, you can't overestimate the importance of that kind of relationship. And invest less in the bureaucracy, invest more in counselors. And that alone would make a big difference. One other thing that a college looking at roadblocks should start with, it's that introductory math class. Now, I don't know about you, I was not a great math student. But colleges typically still require algebra to graduate. And there's just no, algebra is not something that, I don't know if you use it, I certainly don't. What we do use is statistics. So substitute statistics for algebra. And there are curricula out there that have been shown to take students who are behind in math, who really need what would be called remedial math, and include the statistics and a catch-up math course, and you get amazing results. You get 70% of these students at the end of the year with college credit statistics. They start out needing remedial support.
Hmm. I use algebra every day. I don't know.
Sure do you.
Well, David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Sonali, it's been a pleasure.
My guest is David Kirk, professor at UC Berkeley, contributing writer at the New York Times, fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and of the National Academy of Education. We've been talking about his new book, The College Dropout Scandal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.